This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein, and let's just get right into it. China looks to be on the brink of a trade war with the United States. Not surprising, really, considering the Trump administration's recent salvo of tariffs against, well, almost everyone, including its closest allies. It's a head-scratcher for sure, and enough to drive Trump's economic advisor, Gary Cohen, to give up the game and resign his post. With all this happening, China marches onward by building its unilateral view of the world, almost shrugging off U.S. threats. It's a complex and perplexing moment, no doubt. To give us a bit of perspective, we called on Steve Okun, president of the Asia Business Trade Association. Steve heads up the first Pan-Asia Business Association dedicated to the promotion of trade issues and cooperation with governments. I start off by asking him the same question you're probably asking yourself. What should we make of it all?
We want to talk about the steel and aluminum tariffs. I mean, what's confusing is the process in which they've been implemented, but even worse, in a way, is the avenue they chose to implement them. So, I mean, going back, there's no surprise at all that President Trump was going to find a way to have tariffs on goods. He has been saying this literally for 30 years. He's been saying this in the campaign. He's been saying this as president. And so the fact that tariffs are being levied is not a surprise at all. And it was, frankly, should have been fully expected. The issue with these tariffs in particular is the way they've been done. So the U.S. has decided to launch an investigation into whether there is an exemption from the U.S.'s commitments to the WTO on national security when it comes to steel and aluminum. And the U.S. is required under U.S. law to undertake an analysis as to whether or not this is a national security issue. And it does not appear from anything that has been made public and has been actually undercut by what President Trump has said since he announced this, that these aren't national security tariffs. And the Defense Department has said there isn't a national security issue. They did no analysis of whether there was a reliable source from an ally with regards to getting the required steel and aluminum for national security purposes. So there's just no basis for it. And what's even more kind of troubling is that then the way they were implemented is that these tariffs are going to hit our allies much harder than they're going to hit China, because China only imports 2% in. And so if you're China, you're sitting back and watching a trade war erupt between the U.S. and the EU, the U.S. and Mexico, and the U.S. and Canada. And you sit back and do nothing.
It's this blind salvos, and I nobody quite understands. And that's probably explains why China is so relatively quiet around this, because they know that perhaps, you know, not the brightest decisions are being made on the other side of the Pacific.
Well, there doesn't seem to be. I mean, let's go as a starting point. There is no question that there are legitimate issues between the U.S. and China on China's actions on trade. And there are many avenues to take investigations and action if you want. There's what you would call a 201. So there's all these, you know, there's 201, 232, and 301, right, which are parts of the U.S. code, which give the president the authority to take these actions. And 201 is where you need to find that basically China has, violated the principles of dumping or state subsidization of goods that are being imported. Or you could do it on national security grounds, which is 232. Or you could take a 301 case, which is that there is a unfair trade practice outside the WTO process, which is the U.S. is entitled to do under U.S. law. And why you would take a national security provision and use that on where China's imports are the least impactful doesn't really make a strategic sense if your goal is to fix the trade imbalance and improper activities of the Chinese.
What is an example of a trade imbalance where there is a national security risk?
Well, it can be on steel, it can be on iron, it can be on oil, it can be on aluminum. I mean, so it's anything that you would need for your military, and that the foreign imports are driving the ability to get those materials from U.S. manufacturers or from other reliable, safe suppliers, right, like an ally. So there are examples where you can take a national security exemption, but you need to show all of those things, and it does not appear that analysis had been done, especially when, you know, the Department of Defense is saying this isn't a national security issue.
Well, it feels like there's almost a traditional or a Cold War mentality that's reigning. That's like sounds like a discussion that might have gone on, you know, World War One, World War Two era. I think what there are some other examples that are coming up through the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States or CFIUS around, for instance, MoneyGram, which was Ant Financial, Alibaba's group was looking to buy to compete with PayPal or what is it, Lattice Semiconductor, or even the most recent one, Broadcom's bid to take over perhaps Qualcomm. I mean, these sound like it's more about the future of technology where there is a battle being waged. And that's not so much a Cold War issue. That's kind of the future industrial paradigm. Are those more reasonable areas where there might be issues that percolate up around trade?
I don't know if this is, I don't even know if this example of given the president's statements, if this is really a Cold War example, it's going back almost to the 1920s, where it's a protectionist, it's protectionism, and this is where the president said we need to protect our workers and we need to protect our industry, and that is very different than saying this is a national security issue. And then when the president has since said, well, if we get concessions from Canada and Mexico in NAFTA, well, then we'll exempt them from the 232 case. Well, now that completely undercuts your national security argument. Or, right, where the president said, we can exempt the EU if they give us concessions on auto tariffs. I'm not sure he gave auto tariffs specifically, but that again undercuts your argument that it's a national security issue. And then you've now gone back and you can see the White House press secretary says, well, we'll give exemptions based on national security. Well, I mean, you've already said this isn't really a national security issue. It's really a protectionist issue. It's a nationalism issue.
Well, just doesn't this lend itself to just the continued confusion that keeps bubbling out of the White House about what is the policy position and therefore what is the mechanism by which you then drive through an agenda? I mean, this is one more example, is it not?
Well, no, I would disagree because I think their policy is very clear. We are not going to engage multilaterally. We are only going to engage bilaterally. We are going to judge our trade agreements and our trade policy based on whether or not we have a trade budget deficit or surplus on goods and goods alone, ignoring the services economy, of which the U.S. is much stronger than almost anybody else. And then we will find a remedy to take action. And we'll call it 201, we'll call it 232, we'll call it 301, whatever it may be.
So, Steve, a few months ago, you called out these possibilities. You know, you saw the very strong possibility of this happening, and in fact, it has. But now, as it is playing out, and as you pointed out, it shouldn't be any surprise to anybody. This is the way Trump's been talking for a long time. What are your predictions? I mean, how is this going to go down? And I know there's lots of moving parts, but as somebody who's watching, observing daily, these trade discussions, has been an advocate for a free multilateral trade. What is your view on this? What are the things we need to be concerned about, and how will Asia bear up under this?
Well, I don't know exactly how it's going to end, but it's going to end badly. what form that takes.
One thing is assured.
Right. And so, I mean, if you go back to history, not the distant history. I mean, the last time there was really a trade war between the U.S. and the EU was in 2003-2004. And that is when President Bush put tariffs on steel and iron. He did not use 232, he used 201. So this was not a national security. But in the same essence is that you had tariffs on steel and iron, which angered the EU. And so the EU then put tariffs on two things primarily, oranges and autos. And remember, this was an election year, 2004, and George W. Bush needed to win Michigan and Florida. So he wanted to win Michigan and Florida in the presidential election. So as soon as the EU slapped those tariffs on oranges and autos, the U.S. tariffs came down and trade war ended. So it was relatively quick.
And Bush won.
And Bush won. You see exactly the same thing happening where the EU has said, if you put these tariffs on, we are going to go after Kentucky Bourbon, home of Mitch McConnell. We are going to go after Harley Davidson, home of Paul Ryan in Wisconsin. And we're going to go after oranges in Florida.
I'm Steve Stein, and now the second part of my conversation with Steve Okun, president of the Asia Business Trade Association and former chairman of the Asia-Pacific Council of American Chambers of Commerce. He and other Asia-based business leaders have been advocating for U.S. participation in the much-debated Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement, or TPP. Trump's decision to withdraw U.S. support for the TPP was supposed to put a damper on multilateral trade deals, but the deal went ahead anyway. Early this month, the other 11 members signed on, opening the way for billions of dollars of new trade and leaving U.S. farmers, manufacturers, and other exporters in the lurch. I start off the second part of our conversation by looking for a silver lining. Could anything good come of this?
Just because President Trump says something or does something doesn't mean it's wrong, right, or it's bad. There are issues when it comes to overcapacity in steel. There are certainly issues when it comes to technology transfers and IPR infringements by China of global companies. And those do need to be addressed. The question is, how do you address them? Go ahead.
Well, no, it's just the implications are fascinating. So it's like, the intention was to punish China, and the implications have now gone global, impacting some of our closest allies. And it's almost like those 3, 4, 5, steps removed are things that the Trump administration just either didn't anticipate or they anticipated and Trump ignored it. But here we are, right? And the point on this is that it was supposed to be, well, I'm going to punish China for its trade infringements, and that's why I'm doing this. But it's not bearing out.
Not on steel. Now, will it happen on, look at the next, again, they've been running three simultaneous investigations. One, 201, which is the dumping, and they've taken action on, solar and washing machines. And then the second is this 232 on national security grounds for steel and aluminum. And then the third one is what's called 301, and that's that China's engaging in unlawful trade practices in China when it comes to intellectual property rights. And that one will certainly be directed surgically at China.
So that's the one that,
that is still going on. But what's happening in Asia, I mean, to answer the other part of your earlier question, what's happening in Asia is that, countries like Japan and Australia and Singapore and New Zealand are saying, we don't have to have a world where the choice is it's either the U.S. leading or China leading. We can come together and lead. And that's what's, so exciting about the TPP-11. That is something positive.
A trading block.
That's coming forward.
Not a single country.
Not a single country. It's a multi-party trading block that says we need to address 21st century trading issues. Intellectual property rights, like cross-border data flows, like, behind-the-border issues when it comes to competition with state-owned enterprises. And that's what the TPP does. And it does that while also addressing for the first time in such a trade agreement, labor rights and environmental protection.
Yeah, it really feels like, you know, it's either the blunt instrument of bilateral a la Trump or the laser gun, you know, by virtue of multilateral and more forward thinking in terms of how trade is evolving versus the way trade has been.
Yeah, and there's room for all of it. I mean, there, trade, if you have a trade deal and it's not being respected, you have to enforce it. There has to be enforcement of trade deals. There should, sometimes bilateral deals are superior, but you also need, you know, multi-party deals like the TPP. And right now the U.S. is only focused on, you know, trade enforcement and doing it in a way that likely isn't respecting U.S. commitments when it comes to things like the WTO. And it isn't negotiated, it isn't part of the emerging multi-party systems in Asia. And that's what's, you know, so that's what, as businesses out here, we're focusing on what's moving forward.
So in effect, the TPP-11 is going to sideline the U.S., reinforce intra-Asia and intra-block trade between the signing members of the TPP, and it's business as usual. And the big losers in this game would appear to be U.S. consumers and U.S. businesses.
Well, I would say it's more targeted even. The global companies who are in the TPP countries have every right to be part of the TPP so long as those, you know, goods and services remain within the TPP. No different, for example, than Toyota North America is part of NAFTA. Right. So those U.S. businesses, and I'll put air quotes U.S. businesses, those global businesses can benefit TPP. But who will lose out are the companies and industries that can't do that. And an example of that would be U.S. agriculture. Right. I mean, you can't grow U.S. corn in Australia. Right. You can't raise U.S. cattle in Malaysia. And so ag in particular is going to be a loser to Australian agriculture and New Zealand agriculture as examples, which will now have much greater access to markets like Japan and Canada than the U.S. would. And the other loser is SMEs, right? Because SMEs aren't established in Singapore or Malaysia or Vietnam. And so those SMEs are not going to be able to take advantage of the TPP-11 like the SMEs out here.
And then back to your comment on politics, I mean, look at the base, right? The Farm Belt, well, that's a big supporter. And also, you know, small, medium-sized enterprise business owners are ones who supported Trump to a large degree across the country. It sounds like he's maybe the politics won't play in his favor this time.
Well, and when you look at what's happening in you know, where I think the Republicans, certainly the Main Street and Wall Street and establishment Republicans are so frustrated right now is that they should be talking about nothing but tax reform every day between now and the election. They should be talking about the tax cuts. They should be talking about how much money, more money is in consumers' pockets. They should be talking about what this means for businesses. You can put aside whether or not you think that the tax reform was done in a way that's good for the United States long term and what it does to the deficit in the debt. But from a political perspective, the tax reform that was passed was getting to be more politically popular. And that's all the Republicans should be talking about leading up into the midterm elections. But instead, now what we're talking about is tariffs. We're not talking about tax cuts. And you've now given an issue to the red state Democrats who are aligning themselves with Trump because they are, some of them are certainly in favor of tariffs and protecting the industries of steel and aluminum. And so I'm sure, you know, if you're a Republican operative, you're not happy in terms of the politics behind this. And if you're a trade person, you're not happy in terms of the substance behind it.
So, there aren't a lot of happy people out there. Now, back to your earlier comment, I mean, this is going only one way. It's going to be bad.
Yes, it's going to be bad.
This is Inside Asia, and that was the second part of my conversation with Steve Okun, trade policy guru and president of the Asia Business Trade Association. This brings us to our Inside Asia Minute, that moment in the show where we ponder the situation and look to sum things up. It may come as a surprise to say that there's absolutely nothing surprising about where we are with respect to trade. Trump has done exactly what he said he would do, throwing multilateral trade deals under the bus in favor of a belief in himself to strike bilateral deals one country at a time. But who in their right mind would do a deal with Trump, who openly professes America first? It's like starting a discussion with your spouse by saying, "I'm right. As long as we agree on the key point, we can go ahead with the conversation." Well, good luck with that. No one likes massive trade deficits, and it's in the interest of all parties to find parity in trade. Trump feels he can bully his way to better trade deals, but that flies in the face of every economic and political convention tested over hundreds of years of global trade. The U.S. isn't the first or the last empire to threaten a trade war to get its way. There are occasionally short-term gains, but inevitably the laws of free trade prevail and the system self-corrects. But Trump is no student of history, nor apparently of economics. The time has come to throw away the carrot and favor the stick, so he believes. He seeks to impose a level playing field and collateral damage be damned. Okun reminds us that what Trump's tariff-loving political base gives, so it takes away. We've seen this before. When George Bush imposed tariffs to protect Florida orange growers and Michigan automakers, trade partners reacted swiftly, imposing tariffs of their own. Rather than risk a rapid escalation of trade barriers, Bush backed down and in so doing narrowly averted an all-out trade war. If the same thing happens this time and everyone from the Canadians to the Europeans begin retaliating, what will Trump do? Back down? It's a terrifying question in light of Trump's apparent intransigence to any form of advice or criticism in any area of public or international policy. What Trump does or doesn't do is anyone's guess. In the meantime, the really crucial thing, says Okun, is the emergence of new trading blocs that could leave U.S. companies in the dust. The newly signed TPP-11 brings together diverse countries with shared interests and the leverage necessary to change the conversation, maybe forever. Can anything good come of the trade wars? Okun says it's likely to end badly, and he's probably right. We're in the midst of a new world order. American trade might is no longer what it once was, and it may be through this time of chaos that a new order will emerge. A time when reason, not power, rules the day. We can only hope. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.